Support for NPR comes from LendingTree, where you can choose from up to 4 customized loan offers. 1-800-555-TREE. When banks compete, you win. LendingTree.com. From Angie's List, providing firsthand consumer reviews on local service like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at AngiesList.com. And from Progressive Insurance, sponsor of the Progressive Automotive X Prize, a race to develop cars that exceed 100 miles per gallon. Now, that's Progressive.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter Seymour Hersh. He broke much of the Abu Ghraib story and won a National Magazine Award for Public Interest in 2006 for his New Yorker pieces on intelligence and the Iraq War. He's still investigating the Bush administration for a book he's writing. In fact, he was in the headlines earlier this month when he said during an event at the University of Minnesota that he's learned that an operation of the military's Joint Special Operations Command reported directly to Vice President Cheney's office. He described it as essentially an executive assassination wing. We'll talk about that a little later. Let's start with Hersh's article in the current edition of The New Yorker, which is about a possible game changer in the Middle East. The story is called Syria Calling, the Obama administration's chance to engage in a Middle East peace. Hersh reports that Syrian President Bashar Assad and Israel's new prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, may be ready to negotiate if the U.S. acts as mediator. Seymour Hersh, welcome back to Fresh Air. Now, after the Israeli ceasefire in Gaza, you got an email from the Syrian Prime Minister, Bashar Assad, saying that although Israel was doing everything possible to undermine the prospects for peace, quote, we still need to conclude our serious dialogue to lead us to peace, unquote. But didn't Bashar Assad just say that Israel only spoke the language of blood? Didn't he just call on the Arab world to boycott Israel and close Israeli embassies in the region and sever all contact with Israel? I mean, he said that after the Israeli ceasefire in Gaza, which wasn't very long ago.
Oh, absolutely. And there's nothing like the dexterity of politicians and government leaders. What happens simply, and I think this is a significant fact, is that Israel's game plan to whatever it really was, to destroy Hamas, and I think to kill the leadership, I think Israel failed much more than the you might know from reading all the newspaper accounts. I think their goal initially, it was to really take out the leadership of Hamas. The neoconservatives in the Bush days, they always used to use the model of the Carthaginian War. I'm serious. Salt the earth, the Third Punic War. And it was to salt the earth and make it unlivable for Hamas to survive in Gaza. That's why the bombing was so intense. That's why they were so persistent, despite the large a number of innocents killed and the horrible photographs that we all saw. Israel failed in that attempt. Hamas survived. Hamas wins by surviving. And I think Bashar became, I've been told this by his senior aides, not by him. He wouldn't speak that way to me. But his very close aides said, look, this was basically a debacle for the Israelis. They lost in public opinion. They didn't get rid of Hamas. Look what's going on now. The world is paying more attention to Hamas. There's many more demands for the Israelis and for the United States to start dealing directly with Hamas. This is very much in the picture. I think we're going to see soon direct contacts from the West, certainly starting with Europe, with Hamas. And so from that point of view, President Assad had every reason to change his mind and decide, let's go ahead. He's dealing with a weakened Israel. He's dealing with a new American president who just might appreciate the fact that the president of Syria is willing to turn away from his anger and try to seek peace. And I think that's all part of the big game plan that's going on now.
You say that Syria's ultimate aim in negotiating with Israel and using the United States as the negotiator would be to persuade Obama to abandon the Bush administration's strategy of aligning America with the, quote, moderate Arab Sunni states. Can you talk a little bit more about that as an ultimate aim for Syria?
Sure. Let me tell you first what happened. The Bush administration, and Richard Cheney, the vice president, was very key in this, evolved a policy that one could call the Arabs, some of the Arabs very angrily would call fitna, an Arab word for Muslim brother fighting brother. The policy basically was, let's get the moderate, we call moderate, Sunni countries, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and Jordan, all of which are not democracies, by the way, so much for Bush's talk about democracy. But get those three countries, particularly the Saudis with their money, working with America and also Israel. And as they were sort of a combine, and all of them, Israel, America, the Sunni countries, working against Shia Iran. The idea was to put pressure on Shia Iran and also Shia Hezbollah. Hezbollah is the one-time terrorist group that's now a political unit inside Lebanon, but it's certainly totally Shia. And so the idea was to get a Sunni world. The Sunnis are about 90% of the make up 90% of the population in terms of religion in the Arab world. Get them against Iran and Hezbollah. This was always the game plan. And what Assad wants to do, and of course, he's going to these negotiations understanding it's going to be very tough to do. But he's got a new partner now in Obama, and he's putting the reason he was so open with me and others, I'm sure, is they want to put as much pressure on this White House as they can about these issues. He wants to change the paradigm. You know, it is amazing. After 8 years of what I think will arguably be the worst president we've ever had, not only economically, as we all know, but in terms of foreign policy, there still is a very interesting chance for peace. Here's what the play is. We absolutely, to get out of Iraq, we really do need the neighboring countries to help us. We need Syria, which has a lot of influence with Iraq. We don't want Iraq to become cowboys and Indians, and we don't want to see it as we pull out. We don't want to see internecine warfare between the various warlords and war groups and the Sunnis and Shias. And one way of moderating, we do understand, this is clearly, I'm not telling anything that isn't sort of the old cliche about not rocket scientists. We need people like the Turks, the Syrians, and the Iranians to help us get our way out of, extract our troops and leave Iraq in some sort of reasonable position. We also would love to have the Iranians, who have a lot of influence inside Afghanistan. So what Bashar is trying to do is to get Washington to somehow find a way, and boy, is this going to be hard, to open up with Iran on these regional issues, open up with Syria, continue to work with the Turks, who were very angry about Gaza but are staying there. They're still the Israeli ally, the Turks, and somehow handle Israel in all of this. It's a really difficult diplomatic problem. And I ended my piece by saying it's going to be very hard to pull off. But just imagine if we could pull it off, we would resolve so many problems in the Middle East.
Well, what about Israel? Israel has a new prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, who is very conservative and hasn't really supported the peace process in the past, but he appears to be willing to talk to Syria about the Golan Heights. So why is Netanyahu leaning, apparently, toward negotiating with Syria?
Well, that's obviously a question that I spent a lot of time worrying about and talking about. There's no question he's passing that message now quite avidly. In wonderful Israeli style, one of the messages that were passed to the Syrians privately about 6 months ago was during the campaign, the Israeli election took place in February, and it was a very bitter campaign. Bibi Netanyahu passed word that he is going to continue the talks. He might not do it for a few months because when he wins the election, he doesn't want to rush into talks because he doesn't want people to think that he's doing the talks that were started by the previous government. He wants to make them his own, which is very Israeli, if you will. He's also passed the message repeatedly to this administration. Why? Not because of any noble gestures. It's because they believe that the real target is Iran. They believe that as awful as things are with Hamas and the Palestinian, that whole problem, the problem of suicide bombers, those are not strategic issues for the Israelis. They are tactical issues that are being dealt with. You kill somebody, they kill somebody. For them, the Iranians are the big game. They think Iran is going to get a bomb very soon and is crazy enough to use it against one of their major cities, even though it would mean the end of Iranian civilization. That's what the Israelis profoundly believe. And there's no question about that. That's a serious issue. For the Israelis, then, to cut a deal with Syria, in their view, removes the threat from the north. They don't have to worry so much about that border. They can shift the military weapons and missiles from targeting Syria more towards Iran. And more importantly, it's a process of isolation. They believe that if you can get Syria into an agreement with the West, inevitably, inevitably Syria will walk away from its obligations and its responsibilities or its closeness to the Iranians. That's just inevitable. So that's a reason for some of the wise people in Israel to want to do it without even that many preconditions. Don't worry about what he says. Get him in the deal because time will be to our advantage. And then if in 2 years, if we decide we have to bomb Iran, Syria will stay out of it. That's the Israeli view.
The negotiations would be about most specifically the return of the Golan Heights to Syria, which Israel captured from Syria in the 1967 Six-Day War. What's the importance of the Golan Heights both to Syria and to Israel?
Well, for Syria, it's homeland. It's not a biblical land. It's not like we're talking about Bethlehem in the West Bank or something for the Palestinians. It doesn't have that kind of biblical history. It's an area of a lot of water. It's a mountainous region. A lot of snow collects there, a lot of water runoff. I mean, all kinds of water flows, and it flows indirectly from Syria into a place called the Shaba Farms in the southern Lebanon that's in dispute too. And so there's a lot of riparian rights. Water is going to be, as we all know, a huge issue, and it always is a huge issue in the Middle East. So that's another factor. I think what got me interested in the story last year, and I started working on this well before Gaza last fall, I knew that there had been a series of informal talks done with through the auspices of the Turkish government between Israel and the Syrians. And in those talks, amazing progress was made, so I heard, to the point where most of the major issues were done, the technical issues, who's going to get what water, how are they going to deal with it, what's the geographical boundaries, where will the troops be displayed. For Israel, of course, the Golan Heights is not only an area of water supply, but also highland, an area, you know, no country wants to give up the highland. The Syrians could theoretically, in a war, use the higher position, the elevated mountains, to fire shells at them, et cetera, et cetera. So from a security point of view, a sort of a tactical security point of view, they were always considered important. But it was more than that. I think now, because about 20,000 Israelis have settled in the Golan Heights since 1967, it's become an area of wonderful wineries because of the mountainous region, and apparently the weather is just perfect for growing grapes, boutique hotels. It's a wonderful place to go and spend a weekend. And so there's also skiing there on Mount Hermon. It's one of the few places. I think the Israelis will keep the skiing area of Mount Hermon. That's part of the deal. And the only problem with the Israeli point of view was, of course, under international law, it's well known that any country that takes land by force has to return it. And they hadn't done that in this case.
So how do you think negotiations between Syria and Israel, brokered by the U.S., would play among the Syrian people?
Oh, very well. I've actually looked into that. There's a great deal of eagerness to change the paradigm there too, really. And they are really eager to look to the West. I'm talking about the business class. And also, don't forget, it would improve the economics of Syria. Right now, there's tremendous problems in education and health care. He doesn't have enough money for good hospitals. He doesn't have enough money for the better schools he needs. And President Assad is most interesting. He's demanding that every child age 6 and on, the second language they have be English. I quote somebody as saying he's been trying to say yes to us for 6 years, and we just haven't listened.
You raise a question that obviously you don't have the answer to, but I'll ask you anyways. You raise the question, will the Obama administration have the diplomatic skills to pull this off? So from what you've seen so far, what are you thinking?
You know, it's always dangerous to ask somebody what you think. I go nuts every time I watch cable TV shows, and they have reporters on. They begin every sentence with the word "I think." You know, A, they don't, and B, they don't know anything. So, on that basis, having said that, disqualifying myself, I'll tell you something about Obama. He's the first American president that understands the Islamic world. He grew up spent a few years in Indonesia. At a time when the Wahhabism, the Saudis were very influential there, there was a lot of talk about various kinds of different sects and tracks of the Muslim religious world were competing for each other. The other thing I wrote about is that he met with Jimmy Carter, the former president, who is, for many American Jews, he's sort of Darth Vader because he's been, he wrote a book, the previous book, the one before the one he currently has, talked about the apartheid Israel. The notion of the way they treat the Arabs is equivalent to apartheid in South Africa. And so they had a long talk, Mr. Carter and Mr. Obama. And by the way, Carter's people tell me it was the first time since Jimmy Carter left office in 1980 that he's gone back to consult with an American president about current affairs. And it's absolutely possible. And obviously they talked about not only the Middle East a great deal, clearly Hamas and all these issues would be on the table. And so here you have a president, we all know how smart he is, who is, as I said, the most knowledgeable about Islam of any president we've ever had, who's very aware of what the possibilities are in the Middle East, who's already showing his administration's already beginning to talk in terms, as they said to the Syrians, we understand that everything that, you know, that the connections, let's say, between Syria and Hezbollah, as I mentioned, aren't as direct as perhaps the Bush people did. So there's a lot of signs that for the first time, we're going to have a president that's going to be open-minded in terms of the Middle East, and by that I mean always supporting Israel, but not necessarily listening to everything, every argument they make. And that has an immense possibility. In the article, I write very briefly about the fact, I'm amazed it hadn't been reported since, that basically the Obama administration played a role, I think a significant role, in convincing Israel to get out of, stop the Gaza war before his inauguration. Now, it could be Israel was going to do that anyway, but my understanding is not, that there were some people certainly who wanted to go on for another week into late January. And Obama simply passed a series of messages, not the president himself, but some of his senior aides, to the Israelis, making it clear that he wants the bombing to stop and the soldiers out of Gaza before he does his speech on Inauguration Day. And that happened. And that's not inconsiderable. And at the same time, I'm sure he also passed a message to the Israelis saying, I'm still going to be your ally. Don't think that. But the word no blank check gets into play.
So I guess I'm a little confused about what the motivation is here, whether it's to bring Iran into the fold or to isolate Iran.
Well,
and is that depending on whether it's the American point of view or the Israeli point of view?
It's depending on whether it's the Syrian point of view or the Israeli point of view. The Syrians, there are many people in Syria who will tell me, despite what Israel believes, you could isolate Iran by cutting a deal. But from the President Bashar's point of view, Bashar Assad's point of view, I think it's probably the guess is that what he wants to do is use talks to bring Iran into the fold. He doesn't want to isolate Iran. He wants to get America to deal with Iran to bring him in. Into the process, the peace process. For him, it's all about the process. You start the process, and that's what he wants to do. And if nothing else, this is an overwhelming argument for the process. And it's going to put a lot of pressure, I think, on Obama to go ahead and agree to be in the middle of this process.
So how do you think Iran would react to a peace agreement between Syria and Israel? Everybody knows what they want Iran to do, but what do you think Iran would do?
Oh, I think they'd be very hostile to it. I don't think they'd want it. I think publicly they'd say everybody should get back to their country. But I think privately they'd be very, very upset. And the simple answer to the question is Iran will hate it. No question.
President Obama sent that New Year's greeting video to Iran, and the supreme leader of Iran, the Ayatollah Khamenei, rebuffed him. But how do you think Obama is seen among leaders of that region who are not our allies?
Well, I've talked to some, obviously, because I traveled. Not everybody. And by the way, many people we think are our allies are perfectly prepared to be quite scathing about us in private. That makes sense because of the wars we've pushed in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, he's the great hope. And there's an election taking place in a few months in Iran, and you have to measure everything by the electoral politics because it isn't really. They are mullahs, but they have elections that matter there, very serious elections. And Obama's been saying something very interesting about he's been talking when he mentions Iran. He's talked a couple of times now about mutual respect. And what does the Arab world want from us? They want us to be respectful. They're tired of being taken for granted by us. They really want that. And the other thing is he used the language he described as the Islamic Republic of Iran. And that's a different language. He's passing a message to the Iranians, which is unlike the Bush administration's. Forget about regime change. We're not coming for you. We don't want to get rid of you. We want to deal with you. And whatever they say in response, I think he's going to stay consistent on language, changing the language. You start with changing language, and he's changed the language. It's an amazing dance that's going to have to take place. And the problem is, because of the economy, he's not going to get to this for a little while. This can't be something that's high in his agenda, not because he doesn't want it to be. Just common sense would say he's got to fix the ship of America. He's got to get us working again. And this could be an awful summer with people out of jobs and riots and et cetera, et cetera. And I think everybody's worried about that. I'm a cynic. And I'll tell you, on election night, I went to bed. When Obama was named president, I went to bed and thinking I was going to sleep that night with a beautiful virgin princess. And when I woke up in the morning, I said, OK, it's a frog. And you have to deal with it as a frog, and you have to be very skeptical. And I am. And I look at him. There's things he's doing in Afghanistan that worry me. But I don't think we've ever had a president, maybe since Kennedy, who's very, very bright, and so was Lincoln, with the brains this guy has and the capacity to understand things this guy has. And he's also Chicago Powell. Let's remember that. But when it comes to the Middle East, he's going to be given a chance. And Bashar Assad is pushing that envelope. He's been given a chance to make a huge difference. And to think that after 8 years, we still have a reasonable chance of getting something accomplished diplomatically to get the world calmed down and focus on the problems we need to focus on, it's pretty amazing. It just shows you the human race. We're hard. We're hard to put down. There's a lot of good stuff in us.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with investigative reporter Seymour Hersh. He won a Pulitzer Prize in 1970 for breaking the story of the My Lai massacre in Vietnam. More recently, he broke much of the Abu Ghraib story and won a National Magazine Award for Public Interest in 2006 for his New Yorker articles on intelligence and the Iraq War. In the current edition of The New Yorker, Hersh writes that a major change in American policy towards Syria is underway. Well, Seymour Hersh, I know a lot of our listeners are just waiting for me to ask you about comments that you recently made at the University of Minnesota, where you were engaging in an onstage forum. And you said in that forum that Vice President Cheney had an executive assassination ring. And you were talking about the Joint Special Operations Command. You said under Bush's authority, they've been going into countries, not talking to the ambassador or the CIA station chief, and finding people on a list and executing them and leaving. That's been going on in the name of all of us. You're saying that this execution ring that was part of the Joint Special Operations Command reported directly to Vice President Cheney's office. I'm not even sure where to start on this. So let me start with this. And this might sound like a weird question, but don't the special forces, isn't that part of what they do, assassinate people?
Yeah, I mean, not if they have specific knowledge that, let's say, there's a leading member of Al-Qaeda, I think the option is, of course, first to capture if possible. And also, if you've confirmed it and you also have authority to do so. By the way, let me just say this. You can't imagine the heartburn I must cause to my editors at The New Yorker when I say things off the top that aren't as carefully structured as some of the stuff I write.
And I want to make sure that this is that it's clear this is not in The New Yorker.
Is
comments
absolutely.
That you That's made the... on stage as part of the ongoing research. You found this out as part of the ongoing research that you're doing for a book.
What it is, I was in a debate or a conversation with Walter Mondale, the former vice president at the University of Minnesota. He teaches there now. And I was amazed. Walter Mondale has come a long way. And he was almost radical in his denigration of what's been going on in America in the past 8 years. And somebody asked me, are bad things still going on? And what I said was, and here's where it gets complicated in terms of speaking and writing. I actually didn't say anything more than I have written in The New Yorker. Last summer, I wrote a long article in The New Yorker about the Joint Special Operations Command. That's the group you're talking about, JSOC, we call it. And in the article, I made the point that they are delegated by the President of the United States under the law to operate with impunity, without any, going anywhere, as I said, without telling the CIA station chief or the ambassador, going into a series of countries. The president, I think, at least 12, the president has done by executive order, giving them that authority, and kill people they think are al-Qaeda or enemies of the state or high-value targets. And this information is not shared with Congress. And all of that was in the New Yorker last summer. And I've written about JSOC two or three other times because what I was writing last summer was they were engaging in a major operation inside Iran. And as far as I know, elements of that operation are still going on. So in terms of the basic story, if I were writing and I was a little more careful and nuanced, and you know, damn it, I always forget there's somebody in every audience with, you know, this is the day of the internet and media.
There's no way you're going to say anything that isn't being recorded.
Yeah, it was a snowy night and they expected a big crowd. They sold a lot of tickets for it. It was one of those events in Minnesota. Anyway, freeze time it. In 2005, 2006, they were really banging on people. The high-value targets, they were operating. JSOC was operating. You got promoted from within by the number of kills you had. I'm not exaggerating. Congress knew nothing about it. When Congress asked to get into this program, I'm not talking about the average congressman. I'm talking about the guys who are the senior players. In this case, the House Defense Appropriations Subcommittee has a small group of four. Dave Obie, the chairman of the committee, is one of them, and so is John Murtha, the longtime former Marine from Pennsylvania, longtime members of the House. This is the most secret committee in Congress, and they couldn't get access to what's going on. Under the law, any program that the military does has to be funded by Congress. And I think I'm going to write, and I didn't say this publicly, but I'll just say it right now. I'm going to write that many of these operations in the early days after 9/11 were probably funded off the books by this White House illegally. So they didn't have to tell Congress anything. That pattern continued. So this group in 2005, 2006, they were operating on their own. They were killing people. I'm not faulting the guys doing it. They were doing their job. But for a certain period of time, all of the names were submitted to the vice president's office for a clearance process before. I don't know how long that continued. I'm sure now it's changed.
So basically what you're reporting here, among other things, is that this team of special forces that was charged with assassinating high-value targets was cleared only through the vice president's office,
you know,
when it should have been cleared by Congress as well.
Well, the whole program wasn't told to Congress very much. Congress may know something about it. They were very suspicious about it. In July of last year, unfortunately, it's an election year, and so anything that wasn't about the election last summer didn't get much attention. I wrote that the senior members of the Appropriations Subcommittee that deals with the most secret issues were stunned when they were confronted with, for the first time, some evidence of the extent of what the Joint Special Operations Command does. There's been a real problem in terms of this special unit. It isn't that the way it got, as what I said in Minnesota, ended up in some blogs and on cable TV as Cheney running a death squad. No, what happened is in the early days, they would clear through the vice president office their operations, who they were doing, who they were going to hit. Just as in the early days of Guantanamo, and I've written about this when I wrote about Abu Ghraib, in the early days of Guantanamo, when they had a prisoner in 02 and 03 and they wanted to escalate the what they don't call torture, but I will, the torture they used to extract lousy information from them, you had to get, it either had to be signed off in most cases, in cases of the serious prisoners, it had to be signed off by Paul Wolfowitz, the Deputy Secretary of Defense, or Rumsfeld, or somebody that high in the Pentagon. So when it came to the high-value target hunting killer teams, they need to clear what they did with the vice president's office. And that's what was going on. Whether it still exists that way today, and that didn't come across in what I said in Minnesota because I rather stupidly didn't make it clear that I was talking about then as opposed to today, is that I'm sure that's changed now. And one reason it's changed is that the man who ran that operation was promoted by George Bush a few years ago to be in charge of all operations for the Joint Chiefs of Staff. His name is Stan McChrystal. And so since you now have somebody inside the Joint Chiefs of Staff who used to run the program, the idea that these operations aren't known to the military is sort of silly. Of course they are. But 3 years ago, 2.5 years ago, no way.
So do you think that the kind of assassinations that you're talking about are still going on, but only with approval?
I don't know what's going on with the Obama administration. I know until the end of the Bush administration, there was a lot of very ugly stuff going on. Of course, a lot of the stuff they did was very appropriate, the Joint Special Operations Command. They would try and collect intelligence. They would try and grab prisoners. But when they had to, if they had a high-value target and they were sure that they had a very bad guy, we would get him.
Now, you said that some of the stuff that you described at the University of Minnesota that made headlines, you'd already basically reported.
In the New Yorker.
One of the differences that on stage at the University of Minnesota, you called it an executive assassination ring. In the New Yorker, you talked about how the Bush administration wasn't requiring a special finding from Congress before authorizing the assassinations. I mean, the language was much more technical in the New Yorker.
Much better, much sensible, which is why.
Did you have any regrets about calling it an executive assassination ring? I mean, that's kind of language that really makes headlines.
Actually, the word was wing, but don't worry about it. I mean, because.
A wing. You know, okay.
We're just talking about it. But the point is that, of course, what I said, executive assassination ring, is a loaded phrase and was absolutely. I don't dispute any of the facts. But using a phrase like that, that's the reason why people like me, despite the fact I scream and yell about editors, really like editors.
Congressman Dennis Kucinich is requesting an investigation into your allegations about Cheney's office authorizing these assassinations without congressional approval. And he doesn't want to wait until your book comes out. and so what do you think of that idea of a congressional investigation?
Well, I think if he probably checked with the House Defense Appropriations Subcommittee, he'll find that after the article I wrote last summer, they did begin an investigation. They did ask a few members of the House Defense Appropriations Subcommittee to gather up the forces. The Defense Appropriations Subcommittee in the House is unusual in that it has an investigation arm that not many people know that much about. It's not a secret. It's just they have about a dozen guys, some of them FBI, CIA, former GAO guys, Government Accounting Office people, that have done a lot of investigations for them in classified areas. They did ask. The last time I thought about it, I heard about it, they wanted to investigate the Joint Special Operations Command because they were not being briefed. Mr. Cheney said to them, well, I'm not going to give you clearance. You cannot have clearance for it. And they said, well, we're the most secret group. We have clearance for the most secret things. And Cheney said, if you don't like what I'm saying, sue me. And that's the last I heard about it last fall. I don't know if they got the clearance. I don't know what this administration is going to do. I just think Kucinich will probably find out I haven't talked to him. He didn't call me. But if he had, I would have told him to go to the House Appropriations Committee to its chairman, David Obie of Wisconsin, and see what they've done, because I know they were very interested in the same issue.
My guest is investigative journalist Seymour Hersh. After recording our interview, we contacted the U.S. Special Operations Command for comment regarding Hersh's assertions that former Vice President Dick Cheney authorized JSOC operations to kill high-level targets. They sent us the following response, quote, Mr. Hersh's assertions are not correct. The Joint Special Operations Command is a subordinate unit of U.S. Special Operations Command and, like all U.S. military units, reports through a military chain of command to the Secretary of Defense and the President. The Vice President is not in the military chain of command and has no command and control authorities over the U.S. military. Congress has oversight over all U.S. forces, including special operations. Unquote. You investigated the Bush administration throughout the Bush administration, always looking for ways that they might have been going beyond executive authority and taking on new powers. And now that the Bush administration is over, you're still investigating what they did and where they might have violated the law. Is investigating that any different for you as a journalist post-Bush administration than it was during the Bush administration? Are more people coming forward now that the president and vice president are no longer in power?
You know, it's a great question because I did think I had a lot of people that had told me in the last year of Bush, call me next February. And so far, even people that are out are still chary because, you know, not so much Bush, but Cheney really is. He's really smart. In the article this week in the New Yorker that's coming out this week, I mentioned that at one point last fall, Mr. Miliband, the young foreign secretary of Britain, unilaterally, without telling the White House, made a trip to Syria to see the President Assad, and his intelligence chief, his MI6 chief, went before him. And Bush, Cheney didn't know about it until actually they were there. And Cheney at a meeting, and I can tell you, I do have access and I have had, and I've been very careful of how I use it, to a lot of stuff from meetings in the White House. And at a meeting, he railed on about perfidious Albion, you know, that the old Shakespeare term for England, and that was used during the Revolutionary War as a pejorative term for England. Perfidious Albion, he said, he is, you know, Cheney is really underestimated. It's easy to make a caricature of him. He's very, very bright. And he's also, in person, much more open-minded in a sense. I'm talking about not politically. You could go and the most disparate people in the world go and have had social evenings with him and his wife and talking about the current, as long as you don't get into politics, and movies and stuff like that. He's easy to make a caricature, but he's much more formidable than people think. Got a rap clap memory, understands bureaucracy much better. He's been around forever, has had every job.
Are you saying that you think Vice President Cheney is still having a chilling effect on people who might otherwise be coming forward and revealing things to you about what happened in the Bush-Cheney administration?
I'll make it worse. I think he's put people left. He's put people back. It's what they call it, a stay behind. It's sort of an intelligence term of art. When you leave a country and you've driven out, you've lost the war, you leave people behind. It's a stay behind that you can continue to have contacts with to do sabotage, whatever you want to do. Cheney's left a stay behind. He's got people in a lot of agencies that still tell him what's going on, particularly in defense, obviously, and also in the NSC. There's still people that talk to him. He still knows what's going on. Can he still control policy up to a point? Probably up to a point, a minor point, but he's still there. He's still a presence. And again, because of the problems this administration is having filling jobs, a lot of people who served in the Bush-Cheney government, particularly even in the White House, people on most sophisticated staffs are still there. You simply can't get rid of everybody. You may not even want to. Some are professional people. But Cheney is, I would never call it admiration, but you know, formidable, yeah, this guy is the real McCoy.
So one more thing. You've for years been writing about basically the present, or at least the present administration. And now you're doing a book that's about the past. It's about the Bush-Cheney administration, which is no longer in power. So I'd just like to briefly hear why you're continuing to investigate the Bush-Cheney administration as opposed to spending all of your time on what's happening now.
I don't want to start analyzing what I do. If I started analyzing it,
That's all right.
God knows. You know, I don't mean, I'm not saying don't ask me that question. I'm just saying, why do I always want to make, one of the things you ask yourself, why do I want to spend my time making other people look bad? What happened in my childhood that wants me to do this? Do you know what I mean? But the bottom line is, I don't think we begin to nearly know what happened.
Right. Okay.
I'm telling you, there's never been a government this secret. And Bush, I can tell you now, I can cherry pick inside Obama like you can't believe. I mean, it's just like taking candy from a baby. I mean, I'll tell you, they had a very interesting principals meeting the other week about Afghanistan. And I know an awful lot about it. I'm not bragging. I'm just telling you. You know, it's just so much harder to work against Cheney right now. Even if he's out, it's just so much more rewarding. One of the stories that got me very early years ago, there was a young officer assigned there, quite brilliant. And there's something called the Situation Room in the White House where the very bushy-tailed, bright colonels and Navy captains go, and they're all going to make admiral. And they're the guys who funnel all of the intelligence reports from the CIA and the NSA for the National Security Advisor. And one of the guys, this is in the middle of the Bush-Cheney years, after 04, and a guy comes in, and he's, high up in his class at the War College. And by the way, don't underestimate the military. They're really good. And this guy read the regs, and he's there and he discovers all of these top secret hot pieces of paper, urgent stuff that's supposed to be under the law, under the procedures, to immediately go to the National Security Advisor, which would be, then it was Condoleezza Rice in the first term. And the law says that she's, in one case, the National Security Agency, which monitors communications, if they have something called a critic, an urgent message for the president, within 10 minutes, it's got to be on the desk, under the law or executive rules, it has to be on the desk of the National Security Advisor. So this guy reads it, but everybody's giving everything to Scooter Libby, the National Security Advisor for Cheney. And he starts saying, hey, guys, we're not doing it right. It's not supposed to go to the vice president. It's supposed to go to the president's person, Condi, not the scooter. And he's told, forget about it. He makes a fuss. And one day he makes a move to do something for Condi. And he's 13,000 miles away the next Monday.
Right.
Didn't lose his promotions. He managed to make his, got his two or three stars. 13,000 miles away, you know, within a, with, you know, the orders were cut. Maybe it took him longer to move, but he was out of there quick. And it's an amazing place. You know, the more you know about it, the more fascinating you get because they were controlling power.
Seymour Hersh, thank you so much for talking with us.
Glad to be here.
Seymour Hersh is a staff writer for The New Yorker. His article in the current edition is called Syria Calling, the Obama Administration's Chance to Engage in a Middle East Peace. This is Fresh Air. You can't turn on the TV or read an article about Wall Street excesses these days that doesn't label the public mood as populist rage. But our linguist, Jeff Nunberg, isn't sure how that's different from just being angry.
Rage is all the rage right now, particularly when it's of the populist sort. Over the last month, I counted almost 200 news stories that paired populist with items like rage, fury, and frenzy, four times as many as in the whole of 2008. And there were more than 100 articles that mentioned AIG along with Pitchfork, which was the implement that Stephen Colbert obligingly brandished as he urged his listeners to join him in forming an angry mob. The cover of the most recent Newsweek announced a feature section called The Thinking Man's Guide to Populist Rage over a still from the 1931 film version of Frankenstein that shows the villagers in pursuit of the monster with torches, cudgels, and dogs. Tongue-in-cheek or not, those images suggest the specters that the word populism triggers in a lot of people: demagoguery, social disorder, mob rule, and a new age of class warfare. In a Wall Street Journal op-ed, Suzanne Garment warned Obama that you couldn't just stir up a little bit of populism and turn it off when it gets inconvenient. Populism is dangerous, she said, recalling the racism that tainted some adherents of the original capital P populist, the radical movement that flourished in the Western states and the South during the Depression of the 1890s. But that's playing a little fast and loose with the P word. Unless you're Stephen Colbert, it's a big jump from figurative pitchforks to literal ones. Whatever people are getting at when they talk about populist rage, it has only a remote etymological connection to those earlier movements. In fact, the small p populist label that people have been throwing around was actually an invention of the age of Nixon, not the age of McKinley. For more than half a century after the original populist fell apart around 1900, their name was consigned to the dustbin of history, along with other forgotten third-party movements like the Free Soilers and the Greenbackers. It was only with a political realignment of the late 60s that people revived the word populism to describe the candidates who were wooing the votes of blue-collar workers and white Southerners who had abandoned their traditional allegiance to the Democrats. George Wallace was designated a populist, and so were Spiro Agnew and Hubert Humphrey. By 1972, the historian C. Van Woodward could write an article in the New York Times called "The Ghost of Populism Walks Again." He marveled at the way the word populist was suddenly turning up in improbable and unaccustomed quarters that would have astonished the 19th century agrarian radicals. The historian Michael Kazin has said that populism is less an ideology than a language. Whether they come from the left, right, or center, populists claim to speak for the values of decent, ordinary people against the rich and powerful. But of course, there are a lot of ways to carve the world into us's and them's. You can pit the common man against economic royalists, the people who work hard and play by the rules against the fat cats who work the system, the normal Joe Sixpack American against the out-of-touch Chardonnay-sipping elite. Given that ideological promiscuity, it isn't surprising that populist can be a positive or negative word, sometimes in the same sentence. My populist has the common touch, your populist is a pandering demagogue. But then, any label that can apply to both Lou Dobbs and Hugo Chavez has got to have a fair amount of contextual flex built into it. Still, whoever's deploying it, the language of populism always involves a direct appeal to the emotions. There's a lot of pop in modern populism. Its immediate roots are in Hollywood and Nashville, not the political movements of the 19th century. Listening to Reagan, Clinton, or Palin at their populist best, you don't hear any traces of the florid orotundities of William Jennings Bryan. You hear the echoes of Frank Capra's Little Man movies of the 30s, or of later films like On the Waterfront and 12 Angry Men, or Norma Rae in Rocky. In fact, the biggest risk of modern populism is less that it will devolve into violence than that it will tip from sentimentality into kitsch. It's a short step from Mr. Smith and Mr. Deeds to Joe the Plumber, or from Merle Haggard to Toby Keith. That helps to explain a curious linguistic difference between populist and words like liberal and conservative. We readily describe politicians as populist, but we're hesitant to use the word for the people they're trying to appeal to. We don't talk about populist Americans, populist voters, or populist radio listeners. It's as if the targets of populist rhetoric aren't supposed to be aware they're being worked on. So there's a certain condescension in all those facile references to populist rage. Sure, everybody's angry right now, and with good reason. But why do we have to reach for a special word populist when we're talking about the anger directed at the venality and arrogance of the rich, as if it's inevitably the product of class antagonisms? Don't I have grounds for being angry just in my capacity as a citizen? And for that matter, what entitles everyone to describe the anger as rage, which is the word we use for a violent emotion born of helplessness and powerlessness? Let's credit Americans with a little common sense. What we're seeing is simply an outpouring of public indignation, not populist rage. And that sound you hear isn't pitchforks, just a couple of 100 million people talking back to their car radios.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist who teaches at the School of Information at the University of California at Berkeley. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.